It's been more than a decade since The South Was Right by the Kennedy Brothers first went into print. Now, 100,000 copies plus later, it's still a bestseller. And what about Michael Grissom's Southern by the Grace of God even before that? Both works have been huge successes in rekindling the fires of our Southernness in the hearts of readers all across Dixie. And both share something else in common along with hundreds of other Southern works. Both are published by the only major pro-Southern publishing house in America, Pelican Publishing. Under the visionary work of Dr. Milburn Calhoun, Pelican Publishing has spent the last 37 years returning to its roots in providing Southern authors an alternative to Northern publishing houses. So whether you're an author looking for someone to publish your own manuscript, or you're just interested in reading a good book, go to ePelican.com today and browse around. You'll find books on a huge number of topics, Southern and beyond, as well as a friendly staff who know how to support Southern authors in getting their works out to the public. Pelican Publishing, giving us all a better choice. Visit us today at ePelican.com.
And welcome to another live program here at Dixie Broadcasting. And as we do almost every Wednesday night, we're bringing you another Pelican Pages interview. And we are very pleased to have the guest with us that we have on the show tonight. As we start the program, though, I want to remind you that during the interview tonight, or as you're listening to this later on, you can actually find out more about the author and the book we're going to be looking at by going to the Pelican website at ePelican.com. That's www.epelican.com. And you can browse through all the books, or you can do a search on this particular book, and you can actually order this book online at a reduced price from Pelican. Of course, you can find almost all of the Pelican titles on the bookshelf at any major bookstore across the country. And if they don't have it, they can probably get it for you in about 2 days' time. So we encourage you to take a look for this book the next time you go in the bookstore, and maybe even make a trip down there tomorrow just to look for it. But without any further ado, let me introduce our guest tonight. We are very pleased to have Mr. David Johnson on the line with us for this interview. And David is the author of a biography of Douglas Southall Freeman. Douglas Southall Freeman is, of course, one of the great biographers of Southerners in our history. And David, this is pretty much the definitive work on the life of Mr. Freeman. There really isn't that much out there, is there?
Well, that's the reason that I got into writing it, was there was no single biography on Dr. Freeman. There were numerous lengthy magazine articles, and usually when the book reviews would come out, they would include a sketch. But there was no one place where a reader with some interest might go. So that sparked my interest and gave me the opportunity to spend some time with him and to produce this book.
Now, you currently serve as the Deputy Attorney General there in Virginia. And by the way, David lives in the our nation's capital right there in Richmond, Virginia. And David, why don't you start out by just telling us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in your topic in a little more in depth, and the Southern history in general, I guess.
Well, I think you hit on a little bit of it. I was practicing law before I went to the Attorney General's office, just in private practice, and I've always been a history buff. I studied at William & Mary under the great Ludwell Johnson, who I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with. He, along, I think, with Clyde Wilson, are the two preeminent Southern historians around on college campuses that are still allowed to be there. And when I was practicing law, I decided I would start writing history articles on the side, and most of them were about incidents in Southern history. I wrote a story, a recount of Preston Brooks' caning of Senator Sumner, and I wrote one on the relationship between Jefferson Davis and Andrew Johnson. And I was casting around for a topic, and I was familiar with Dr. Freeman, first of all, from studying under Professor Johnson, but also being in Richmond. There's a Freeman High School, and he went to the University of Richmond and was rector here, and then was editor of the newspaper here. So I'd heard about him. And, of course, I had read much of R.E. Lee and Lee's Lieutenants. So I thought there might be enough for a magazine-length article. And as I began to dig around, I discovered that there was a lot of information there. His papers were all in the Library of Congress, which is in Washington, fairly close to Richmond, 100 miles or so away. And his two surviving children were still living in Richmond. So the resources were there to do this. So the interest in just writing in general grew into the interest in writing in a book. And then Dr. Freeman presented, I think, a fascinating figure, not only the two-time Pulitzer Prize winner and the, I think, definitive biographer of Lee and the Confederate effort in the Eastern Theater, but also he was the editor of the Richmond News Leader, which was the evening paper here in Richmond for 34 years, from 1915 until he retired from that in 1949, which are some tumultuous years upon which he was commenting. He was also a close friend and advisor to modern figures. Generals Eisenhower and Marshall relied heavily on his advice during the Second World War. And these are things that weren't really commonly known about him. So the more I stuck with him, the more I thought, well, there's enough material here for a book. And I also felt that probably nobody else was going to do it anytime soon. And since I knew I'd be practicing law and writing at the same time, I knew it was going to take a while, and it ended up taking about 6 years.
Well, he certainly was a very busy man. It almost seems like he crammed enough accomplishments into one lifetime to have lasted for several men there.
He certainly did, and not only did he do all of these things, he did them all well. I mean, as a writer and a historian, he wins the Pulitzer Prize. As an analyst of military matters, I can't think of many of his conclusions that he drew about Lee or the Army of Northern Virginia that have been successfully countered by any historian in the now, I guess, almost 60 to 70 years since both those books first came out. As a newspaper editor, he was widely acclaimed. He was offered the editorship of several other larger papers, including the Washington Post, because of his newspaper ability. So yes, he had to get up pretty early to do it, and that was part of his secret. He got up at 2:30 in the morning.
Wow.
And didn't go to bed until about 8:30, and he kept up that pace his entire life. And he had to, in order to produce these books and also meet his responsibilities. Not only the newspaper, he was a radio broadcaster, he was the rector of the University of Richmond, he was president of the Southern Historical Society, and numerous other things.
And it seems like even the politically correct crowd, if they attempted to come out with a book to repudiate some of his findings and some of his statements, they would pretty much be discrediting their own work right from the get-go because of the reputation that he does have.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I mean, the Marble Man came out, and that was the most significant attack on Dr. Freeman, and I think that's been shown mostly to be just an opinionated piece anyway. I mean, there are an occasional fact that we've had some subsequent evidence or papers that have come out that were not available to Dr. Freeman that might have altered some of his conclusions, but by and large, if anyone wants to know exactly what Robert E. Lee was doing and when he was doing it at any given time during the war, the first place to go is R. E. Lee by Dr. Freeman, and I can't think of any other work that can say that to this day. And then, of course, Lee's Lieutenants, which came out after R. E. Lee, is really its biography, multiple biography, right, and its military history, and its military tactical analysis. Three books in one, which had never been done the way he did it. He considered that his masterpiece, although Lee and then George Washington are the ones that received the Pulitzers, he was most comfortable and most proud of Lee's Lieutenants.
Now, about how long did it take for him to actually put those different books together?
Well, he received a contract from Scribner's in 1915 to write a one-volume, 75,000-word biography of Robert E. Lee.
And, of course, it was still okay with everybody for that to be part of American history at the time.
Right, right. Scribner's, it's hard to believe now with all the books we've got,
yes,
even both good and bad, that in 1915 there was not a definitive work on Lee.
Hmm.
And so he received this, and he eagerly accepted it. And he began to work and discovered that there were massive amount of material that had never been examined. Lee's papers at Washington College, which is now Washington and Lee University, had never been looked at by any historian. Most of Lee's records when he was superintendent of West Point had not been reviewed. There were collections of Lee's letters in private households all through the South, because you know, people who ever had a letter from Robert E. Lee, they kept them. They didn't give them to museums because they were sacred to most families, particularly in the South. So Freeman realized that there was a massive amount of material out there that had never been looked at, and he was determined to look at it. So the two-year contract slowly began to expand, and Scribners began to write letters to him saying, where's the book, where's the book? And he outlived the first editor he had. His subsequent editor decided that, yes, go ahead and do the definitive work. So a two-year contract turned into a 19-year production. 75,000 words turned out to be 1 million words plus.
Wow.
And one volume turned into four volumes. So he completed R.E. Lee in 1934, 19 years after the agreement was reached with Scribner's. And he finished it, wrote the last sentence on General Lee's birthday. I'm sure he probably timed it that way, but nevertheless he did. So that was a 19-year venture. Then he started at that point, he decided he would do George Washington, and he began to research Washington, and he was uncharacteristically lethargic about it. And as we've already discussed this evening, for a man who did so much, lethargy was not part of his character, and his wife diagnosed it for him. She said, "You've been in General Lee's company for all these years, and you missed that companionship." And he realized that that she was right. He had not yet completed the history of the Army of Northern Virginia, which is what he wanted to do. So he put Washington away, and he commenced Lee's Lieutenants in 1934. And that came, the first volume of that was released in about 1942. And volume 2 the next year, and volume 3 in 1944. So that was about a 10-year project. The time was shorter, obviously, on that, because so much of the research he had done for Lee touched on the lieutenant. So he had much of that material already gathered and reviewed. And so that was a 10-year project. Then he went back to George Washington in 1945, and he continued that until literally the day he died. He wrote six volumes of the life of Washington, which took Washington to the end of Washington's first term, and then his two research assistants produced Volume 7, which finished the last years of Washington's life, and then all seven volumes were awarded a posthumous Pulitzer to Dr. Freeman. So that's how that's about how the time went on that. And then there were a couple little works that were stuck in between. In the middle of Lee's Lieutenants, he went down to Montevello, Alabama, at a girls' school, and gave a lecture called The South to Posterity. And the lectures he gave, three or four nights worth of lectures, he put together in a book of the same title called The South to Posterity, which was the first sort of look at, here's how the history of the war is being written.
Mm-hmm.
Here are the books that are out. Here are the analysis. And it's really an interesting thing for anyone who ever wants to study how the war has been written about by historians from the end of the war, you know, and through the era of Jubal Early and that up until the 30s. Dr. Freeman gives you the first look at that, and it's a very, very capable look. So that was his writing schedule for his books in those years.
And it's amazing that any writer would be very grateful to have just a single work of the scale and magnitude of all three of those definitive works that he produced in his lifetime. So for one man to have three of those as great accomplishments, that's almost unheard of, isn't it, in the literary world?
Yeah, I'm not sure that record's been matched by a historian. There are historians who write good books, but to say definitive studies, I'm not aware of anybody who can come close. And then he was already planning a history of the Second World War, which he was going to write after George Washington.
Wow.
When he passed away, and he would have brought the same meticulous, exhaustive research to that and he was a young, relatively young man in our stand. He was 67 when he passed away, and I think felt that he had another 10 or 15 years left. But you know, we know so much today about hypertension and heart problems and things of that nature that they didn't know back then.
Sure.
And when you're keeping an 18-hour day from about 1934 to 1953, 20-some years, that's going to wear on you.
Yeah, I would imagine. I don't think I could do that for a period of a week or two, let alone for that many years. Now, obviously this man had something within his soul that yearned to tell the story of Lee and the South in general. What was it, you think, that just moved and motivated him for all these years of his life and himself to put into this work?
Well, it's a combination of factors. His father was a veteran. His father fought in the war and survived it. Joined. He grew up in Lynchburg, Virginia, which is in the western part of the state. And his father was wounded at Seven Pines, shot twice, recovered from that, came back and was a courier and was assigned to duty down in Charleston and fought in Beauregard's command, and then came up under Beauregard at the Siege of Petersburg and was there and was surrendered at Appomattox. And so his father had been a soldier and had been in the war. Then when Dr. Freeman was about six, the family moved from Lynchburg to Richmond. And Richmond at that time was not only the capital of the Confederacy, in fact, but it was a symbolic capital. There were veterans who walked the streets. Jefferson Davis's funeral, when he was moved here to Hollywood Cemetery, took place while Dr. Freeman was a boy. He witnessed that. The governor was a Confederate veteran, and the history was all around him. So he heard it from his father. It was all around him at Richmond. And then he went to his first school, was a little school called McGuire School here in Richmond. And John Peyton McGuire was the headmaster, and he was a veteran. And every Friday he would gather the boys around, and he would give them a lecture based on the life of General Lee with a moral application. And so these are the things that were in him and that he was taking in all during his formative years. And then, finally, the key moment came. He went to a reenactment of the Battle of the Crater. This was in 1903. He was about 16. And his father, who had fought at the Battle of the Crater, went with him. And Dr. Freeman saw the veterans there. They reenacted their charge under General Mahone. And then he went back to the hotel, and he wrote about it, and I've got this in the book.
Wow.
Where he said, you know, he saw so many of these veterans, and he made a note to himself at this point, and he said, if someone doesn't write the story of these men, it will be lost forever. I'm going to do it. And
wow.
So he determined at that very young age that he was going to chronicle the history of Lee and Lee's army. And he went to Johns Hopkins after he was graduated from the University of Richmond to get his master's or his doctorate in history. And while he was there, the ladies of the Confederacy here in Richmond asked him if he would come during the summer break and organize the papers of the Confederate White House Confederate Museum, which at that point, our time was in the old Confederate White House.
Mm-hmm.
And they had all these papers and maps and things, didn't exactly know what they were. And so he organized them and published his first book, was called A Calendar of Confederate Papers. That was read by a fellow named Wimberly Durend down in Georgia, who then came to Richmond. Dr. Freeman now graduated from Johns Hopkins and was back in Richmond, asked to have lunch with Dr. Freeman, and presented him with two Morocco covered folders, which were the private dispatches of Jefferson Davis to General Lee and Alida Davis during the war. They
Wow.
had been thought to be lost.
Mm.
And he asked Dr. Freeman if he would annotate them and edit them and release that as a book. So that became his second book, which was Lee's Dispatches to Davis. And that is the book that caught the attention of Scribner's, and then they asked him to do R.E. Lee. So it was a series of things that he was keeping his promise of memorializing the effort of General Lee and the Confederacy, you know, the Army of Northern Virginia. He briefly toyed with writing a history of the Army of Tennessee, and the Western Theater, but he felt more comfortable in this theater, obviously because he was living in Richmond, and that was right. The main focus of his efforts.
And although there are other writers who have attempted to do the same job, certainly there's no one who has preserved for us to the same degree the things that we have from Dr. Freeman.
Now, I don't know if there's anybody who would take the time. I mean, 19 years for a book is a long time.
That's a lot of time.
And I mean, he was meticulous. I went through letter after letter of where he would just write to as many sources as possible to verify the most minor points. I remember particularly on George Washington, where he came across a term of art he wasn't quite sure of. It seemed to be Italian, so he put the question to the Italian embassy in Washington. He came across an old chancery case in old Virginia and put the question to Justice Felix Frankfurter. And he wrote the people at Mount Vernon to try to find out the exact angle of the sun during certain times of days at Mount Vernon, when the flowers grew, when did specific things happen. He once wrote that he never wrote a thing about General Lee that he couldn't document.
Wow.
If he didn't have it from a good source, then he didn't write it. And that takes time. Particularly with, when you're talking about Lee and Washington, even in the years he was writing, there was a lot of nonsense circulating about him,
mm-hmm.
which is something else that's quite interesting. When I was going through his papers, once his reputation was so established, then people would write him with every little story they'd ever heard, and you'd see letters, well, I heard that General Lee once did this, and Freeman would very patiently write back and say, no, this didn't happen, and he would discount all of the fables about Lee and Washington because he became the source.
Hmm. Yeah, in some ways, that probably became more time-consuming than the problem of not being able to find material on Lee, in trying to respond to all of those stories.
Yeah, I think everyone was stunned at the popular success of R.E. Lee when it was released. Everyone knew, at least at the publishing house, that it was going to be a critical success and a very valuable history. But no one expected it to sell the way it did and to be so popular. And part of that is because Dr. Freeman has one advantage over a lot of historians, is he can write very well. His histories are not dull, dry, boring histories. Particularly when you're piling as many facts as he piles in, it can get dull. But he had a great ability to write, and R.E. Lee is one of the most rewarding reads of all time. It still ranks as my personal favorite book. I've never read anyone that comes close to the eloquence that he presents his facts with.
Well, folks, we're talking to David Johnson, who is the author of a book by Pelican entitled Douglas Southall Freeman. It's a definitive biography on this great Southern biographer himself. And you can take a look at this book tonight while you're listening to the broadcast, or if you're listening to it later on, by going to the Pelican website at epelican.com. And when you get to the website there will be a tab at the top of the website that says Browse, and if you'll click on that, you can type in the title of the book, Douglas Southall Freeman, or the author's name, David Johnson, and it'll pull up this book, and you can read a little bit more about it and actually purchase a copy of this book at a reduced price right there on the Pelican website. As we've also mentioned, you can go to just about any major bookstore anywhere across America, and you can probably find this sitting on the shelves. If they do not have it in stock, they can get it from Pelican usually within about 2 days' time for you. So take a look at the book. We're going to take a short break with a couple of interesting announcements, and we'll be right back in just a moment.
Hey, for good, clean family music and commentary, keep it on Dixie Broadcasting.
Yeah. you enjoyed listening to lectures on Southern history and speeches that get you really fired up over your Southern heritage. Now you can listen to them all the time, anytime that you want. Dixie Broadcasting has recently purchased the exclusive rights to nearly 400 speeches and lectures from Apologia Books on all of your favorite topics, from the most requested speakers in the Southern movement today. That's right. Dixie Broadcasting is now the only place you will find these educational and propaganda tools for Southern heritage. Visit the Southern Liberty Store today at DixieBroadcasting.com to search the growing list of titles available on CD or as immediate MP3 downloads. Just one more reason that Dixie Broadcasting is the powerful voice of today's Southern movement.
A famous writer once said, "Talent alone cannot make a writer. There must be a man behind the book, by birth and quality." As the only major Southern publishing house, Pelican Publishing believes that there is something valuable about our Southern way of life, about who we are, and about this place we call home. Something worth putting down in written word on the printed page for future generations. Pelican Publishing is proud of our contribution to helping preserve the history and heritage and culture of the South, and we welcome submissions from authors new and experienced here at Pelican. Our family of authors includes some of the best-known names in Southern heritage today, plus a whole lot more. So whether it's about history or heritage, travel or trees, cooking or culture in general, if it's about the South, Pelican should be your first choice. Visit our website at epelican.com to find out about submitting your own book for consideration. Pelican Publishing, giving Southern authors a better choice.
All right, and welcome back to this Pelican Pages segment. And as the advertisement just stated, if you're a Southern author and you have a manuscript you'd like a publishing house to consider, especially if it has anything to do with Southern history, Southern heritage, or any topic related to the South, you ought to consider submitting a copy of that manuscript to Pelican Publishing. They are the by far the largest pro-Southern publishing house in America, and they are that unapologetically. So you can send your manuscript in. Who knows? You might be the next author interviewed here on another Pelican Pages segment at Dixie Broadcasting. We're speaking tonight with David Johnson, who is the author of Douglas Southall Freeman, a biographical account of the man himself, who was a great biographer of other Southerners, particularly Lee and Washington. And we were talking there during the break, David, about the book. Tell the listeners, if you would, about how long you spent writing this book about Dr. Freeman and some of your encounters along the way in that pursuit.
Well, I think the idea struck me to really try to do a book about 1994, do the book on Freeman about 94. And, you know, practicing law and rearing a family at the same time, I had work on weekends and nights and things of that nature. All of his papers, the majority of them, were at the Library of Congress in 215 boxes. And then at Johns Hopkins, there was about, 25 boxes, and then there's a little bit the Virginia Historical Society. And so I'd have to take days off from work and go up as best I could, and that was a slow process. Then in 2001, the University of Richmond asked me to come on the faculty for just that academic year for the purposes of finishing up the book. They said, "How long will it take you if you do it every day?" And I said, "Well, I think I can knock it off in a year at that point." And so I did. That enabled me to pull, you know, 8 to 10 hours a day. Mm-hmm. So that really expedited the process going on there. But I had some great opportunities. Dr. Freeman was succeeded as editor of the News Leader by James J. Kilpatrick, the national columnist and television commentator, and he is still with us. And he's one of the few people who was on Dr. Freeman's staff who's still alive. Mm-hmm. So I spent a wonderful half a day in his visiting with him in Washington, D.C., and interviewing him about his experiences with Dr. Freeman. And there were several others who had been around during that time. So I had a lot of fun doing that, and then the traveling was enjoyable. The Library of Congress is a really great place to research. And Dr. Freeman was so meticulous and so well organized that his papers are very well organized. He typed almost everything, which is a great relief on a researcher when you're reading. And then if he didn't type, he had just a superb hand. It was almost printing, so his handwriting was very easy to read. So I could go through about three to four boxes a trip to the Library of Congress. So 214 boxes, you can figure how many trips I made up there.
That's a lot of miles.
Yeah. Well, I took the train, and so I would catch the train here in Richmond early in the morning and go up, and I could work then on the train going up, and then coming back I could review what I had done that day, so I was able to use those 4 hours on the train very productively. So it was okay. It certainly was a lot easier than if the papers had been at UCLA or Stanford or in California. It would have really made it impossible, because as Dr. Freeman did, he was just zealous about saying you have to look at it yourself. The writer has to look at the pieces of paper himself. You can't rely on a research assistant, and I found that to be right. And particularly when I was able to go every day to Washington, and you get in sort of a groove with your subject. I got to the point where I could open up a file and I would see a letter coming into Dr. Freeman and be asking something or saying something. I could almost predict what he was going to say, because I got to know him that well through his writings, and I would flip the letter and there would be his response right after it, and it would pretty much be what I had guessed. And that's the sort of relationship I think an author can acquire with his subject if he is immersed in it day in and day out, and begin to think like his subject, while not losing objectivity, but to just know his subject so well that you can anticipate. And Dr. Freeman was a very predictable man. He was very set in his ways, and he had a certain set of values and principles that he followed. So all of those things made the work joyful, even when I was, in those years where I wasn't doing it every day, and I was taking days off as best I could, and writing late at night or on weekends or things of that nature.
And finish up with the story you were telling me off the air there about trying to put in a week on the same schedule as Dr. Freeman.
Oh yeah, well, Dr. Freeman got up at 2:30 in the morning, put in a full day, because he would get to the news leader office by 3:30, and he would work there at the newspaper until 12:30. Then he would drive home, and he would have lunch, and maybe work in his garden or take a walk or relax for a little bit, take a nap at 2:00, and then at 2:30 he would wake up and go into his study, and he would write until 6:30, and he'd have dinner with his family and some evening time, and he would retire promptly at 8:30. And I thought, well, if I'm going to understand this fella, I probably ought to try to do a schedule, a Freeman day or a Freeman week. So I began to push it back a little bit, and I got, I think, to about 4:45 or 4:30, and I was dragging by lunchtime and snapping at everybody, and it just wasn't going to work. So I was unable to meet his high standard of discipline in that regard.
Wow, that's tremendous. By the way, folks, we're talking to David Johnson, who has written a biography of the great Southern biographer Douglas Southall Freeman. And Dr. Freeman, of course, has written the definitive works on both General Lee and George Washington, two great Southerners. And this account of his life is a very definitive work as well by David. One of the things, David, that you mentioned a little while ago is that he died at a relatively early age. I think you said 67, was that right?
That's right.
And yet, he's a man who lived throughout the Second World War, both World Wars, as an adult, and writing commentary on both of those while they're going on as a newsman. And yet, he was born not too many years after the war between the states ended. He was an actual son, not far removed, with his father actually having participated, and his father having, as you said, taken him to an actual, at least one actual reenactment of Confederate veterans after the war. So that certainly, you know, it's almost impossible for someone in our day and time to realize that this man who was writing commentary of Dwight David Eisenhower in World War II was right there, born just after the Yankee War was over with.
Right, he was born in 1886, and so he wasn't too far removed. And as I said earlier, he knew Confederate veterans, actual veterans of the war. He interviewed Colonel Taylor, General Lee's adjunct, who was still alive when he was writing the book. And as a matter of fact, the one opportunity he missed, although he was far too young, I mentioned he was born in Lynchburg and lived there until he was 6 years old. And Jubal Early lived in Lynchburg. And, of course, Jubal Early had a reputation sort of being a, shall we say, a crotchety old fellow.
Yep.
And they used to tell the little boys that General Early would eat a little boy for breakfast. So Dr. Freeman had to walk by General Early's home every morning to go to school, and he ran, he said, by it every morning in fear that Jubal Early would come out. But it's a shame that he wasn't a little bit older, so that he could actually have talked to him and talk to him in a serious way, considering the fact that, of course, Jubal Early was probably one of the first, at least one of the great leaders of the history of the war. After the war, he became the president of the Southern Papers, I think, was what it was called back then,
mm-hmm.
but was a guiding force in the early writing of the history of the war. So. But, you know, one of my favorite stories on that topic that you bring up, and it's not about Dr. Freeman, but I once read an article written by President John Tyler's grandson. Because you remember, John Tyler had 16 children, and then the youngest of that of his children had a number of children up until his old age. So his John Tyler's grandson, he may still be alive, but
wow.
He was certainly alive 5 or 6 years ago. And he was remarking one time, he was on a plane flying overseas into Europe, chatting with someone, and he happened to mention, well, you know, my grandfather once told Thomas Jefferson such and such.
Oh, my goodness.
And he himself was struck by the fact that he could be flying on a jet going to Europe in the, I think this was the 1980s or so,
mm-hmm.
talking about his grandfather who had spoken with Thomas Jefferson.
That's just amazing.
Which is on the point you were getting at, that, you know, we're not all that old of a country, you know, our history is relatively new, and that's another reason why it's vitally important for it to be reported accurately and recorded accurately.
Sure, and you know, it's, I think that even though he's probably the greatest spokesman for his generation, Dr. Freeman represents that generation of adults in America who went through World War I and World War II, and yet they were very much not far removed at all from their Southern roots, their Confederate roots, and it's just amazing to think about how those Americans, those Southerners, were going through those periods of American history with two world wars and still very much consider themselves not in any way to be unpatriotic, but still very much staunch Confederates and sons and daughters of Confederates as well. And that's something we certainly have lost by having lost that generation.
Yes, that view was held, I think, on both sides. You know, the day that George C. Marshall became chief of staff of the Army, which was in late 39 or 40, on his first day in office, he wrote a letter to Dr. Freeman. It wasn't the only letter that went out, but it was one of the letters. And the letter said, as soon as you can, I want you to take me on a tour, guided tour, of several of the battlefields. He wanted to go to Sharpsburg, he wanted to go to Chancellorsville, and he wanted to do the 7 days around Richmond. And he wanted Freeman to guide him. Now, this is George C. Marshall, who is preparing, although we weren't, you know, officially involved at all in the European war.
Right.
I think Marshall and a lot of people felt we would be. Marshall felt it was vitally important to study Confederate tactics. Winston Churchill, when he visited the United States between the wars, he was not prime minister at the time, when he arrived, he said, there's one person I want to meet, and that's Douglas Freeman. He came to Richmond, and Douglas Freeman gave him a personal tour around the battlefields of the 7 days. All of these statesmen, I think, realized that there was, you know, there was important, there was a reason why we should still take a look at what was done and why it was done in the Confederate war effort, that it was of value. Now, you know, that's been in many ways snatched from us because of the unfortunate attitudes we have today, or that are on most of our college campuses, and the political correctness movement, that, well, if it is associated with the Confederacy, it is tainted, it is corrupt, it is profane, and we can learn nothing from it. That's not what, you know, President Roosevelt felt, or General Marshall, or Eisenhower, or Churchill, or all of these host of people who were, you know, unionist in their sentiments, but still felt there is something about Lee and the Confederacy that that they wanted to know about. MacArthur wrote a letter to Freeman, and he said, on nights when I have been faced with lonely decisions, I have felt those chieftains of the gray by my side.
Wow, that's amazing.
And that's the way he viewed it. So there's a lot in what you're saying on that point. And Dr. Freeman, you know, he addressed some of that. I think if he had lived longer, he might have done a little more. I put it in the book. He addressed the issue of the display of the Confederate flag. He addressed the issue of how, you know, what slavery was insofar as a cause of the war or not a cause of the war. And Dr. Freeman said the cause of the war was politicians, and that was his conclusion. But all of these things that we still see talked about ad nauseum today and distorted today, he tried with a very calm, clear voice based in history to give an answer and give a response. And it was accepted. I mean, Dr. Freeman was on the cover of Time magazine in 1948, basically touted as American historian. I mean, can you imagine Time magazine paying attention now, today, to someone who dared to write a biography of Robert E. Lee that wasn't critical of him? I mean, that's how things were viewed in a broader historical context back then, and I think a lot certainly fairer and more correct than it is now.
And really, because of the debt that we owe Dr. Freeman for having written those definitive works on both Lee and Lee's lieutenants, the truth is he's every bit as much a Confederate veteran as his father and those men in the 1860s who actually put on the gray and went out there, because if it were not for his works, we wouldn't have near the wealth of information or understanding about those men that we do.
I think he felt that way. He certainly felt it was his duty to do it, and I think that was part of the reason he pushed himself so much. He felt that he owed it to his father, he owed it to those veterans that he had seen, and he owed it to the cause. You know, he drove by the great statue of General Lee here in Richmond on Monument Avenue every day to the news leader office and back home, and he saluted General Lee every morning and every evening that he did it. And once he rode by and was so preoccupied he forgot, turned around and drove back and did it.
Oh, wow!
Lee was the one constant that he attempted to emulate. Incidentally, he did try, even though he was a little too old, when the First World War broke out, when America went in the First World War. He was already married and a father, and the sole provider for his father was still alive and living with him, and he had had a hernia. So he was disqualified on two or three levels from entering into the First World War, and he still tried and was rejected three times to get into service. And then when the Second World War broke out, and by this time clearly he was too old.
Right.
He wrote General Marshall and begged Marshall, "Would you please put me on your staff or let me do something?" And then he even threatened to try to enlist as a private, and General Marshall said, well, we're not going to allow you to do any of this. And Marshall tried to tell him, you're far more valuable to me doing what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the great mysteries that I was unable to completely answer, because Dr. Freeman was so discreet, he received top secret maps and documents from Marshall for his analysis that he would make and then send in secret back to the War Department all during the war.
Really?
But he was so discreet with it, and he was so private that there aren't any records other than his admission after the war that he did it and Marshall's confirmation of it after the war. And then when the war ended, the Undersecretary of State, John McCloy, took a worldwide mission flight, and he visited all of our military installations and met with the generals who were still over there. Eisenhower was still out, MacArthur was still in Japan. And in assembling his staff, he wrote Dr. Freeman and said, would you please go with me as a civilian advisor? And so Freeman did put away the historical writing for about 2 months.
Mm.
And traveled with the Undersecretary of State and went all the way around the world and met with all these people because of his knowledge. So I think you're absolutely right in saying that he felt an obligation to the cause and also to his nation and to the military service, and was thwarted on it so many times that I think he really felt that his writing and this was his effort, his way of making up for not being able to shoulder the rifle in actual combat.
And I want to give you an opportunity to talk about the painting that provides the cover art for your for the dust jacket on your book. It's an amazing picture, and folks, you're going to have to go to the Pelican website there and take a look at it to see it for yourself. But it has Dr. Freeman, of course, in the foreground, but behind his head you have the profiles there of Lee, and then behind Lee's profile is the profile of General Washington, President Washington, and those two great men that he wrote the definitive biographies for. And it's, I think that picture in itself, as well as the story of Dr. Freeman's life, David, says a lot about the fact that he understood those connections, that those American roots were Southern roots, and they're really one and the same. And it's very unfortunate, like we've already talked about a little bit, that the rest of academia today has missed that point, isn't it?
Well, yes. The cover is the Time magazine cover.
Oh, is that right?
That was drawn by Ernest Hamlin Baker, who was one of the great portraitures of that era. That was what was on the cover of Time.
Mm.
And the original was given to Dr. Freeman and then given to his daughter, and she graciously granted permission for it to be on the cover of the book. So that's where that portrait came from, and I think you're right. That's exactly, I think, the imagery that he would want. Lee's greatest hero, of course, was always George Washington.
Right.
And Lee was Freeman's greatest hero. So it does have that sort of symmetry to it.
What do you think? What do you think, David, was Dr. Freeman's motivation, or not motivation, but what is it you think he was hoping that Americans would take away from reading those three books? You can put them all into one nutshell if you want to, or you can break them up into the two biographies if you'd rather to answer it. What do you think he was hoping the readers would take away after reading those books that he obviously felt were so important for people to have?
I think he felt his writings in private about Lee in his letters, he felt that this was a simple man, and that his simplicity was the secret of his greatness. And he over and over would talk about how he felt that was open and available to any citizen, any person. that Lee was not endowed by anything other than a dedication to his duty. That Lee himself, of course, you know, said that duty is the most sublime word in English language, and that if one could emulate that, you had it within you in your own sphere to be like General Lee, and that he wasn't this unattainable figure. The reason I was kind of pausing is I did pull my book out, and I'll let Freeman speak for himself when he was awarded the Pulitzer for Lee. And here's what he said about, and I think that answer, this will answer your question about what he wanted people to think about it. This is what he said: "I shall be very happy if in this day of false fear, doubtful counsel, and whining attempts to escape the consequences of our own acts, this award brings again to public emulation a man who embodied courage, decision, and a willingness to pay the price of loyalty to his convictions." Now, that's what Dr. Freeman wanted people to get out of Lee.
Wow.
And, you know, when he speaks, and now this is 1934, so we're talking about the Depression, and even then he's saying it was a day of false fear, doubtful counsel, and whining attempts to escape consequences. I don't think of those characteristics when I think of the generation that fought the Great Depression. I think of them today.
Right.
But even if Dr. Freeman felt that that was the way it was back then, here was a man, which he said, to bring to public emulation, someone who embodied courage, decision, and a willingness to pay the price of loyalty to his convictions. And that's consistent, I think, of all his letters. And Washington, I think, was the same sort of thing. There was one slight difference with George Washington, and that was when Freeman began to research it, he discovered more material that had been ignored or missed or not cited in all of the previous Washington works. And at that point, he felt an almost, again, a duty to get all those facts put down somewhere. He was appalled at the fact that there was so much material out there that no one had ever looked at. So with Washington, it was a little different because people were already admiring George Washington
right, by
the time he was getting around to it. And he felt, if you're going to, at least with Washington, what you need to get from Washington is, here's why he's great. Freeman does not attempt to say he's not great, but he attempts to say, here are the real reasons he is great. There's another quote, I think, that in the book he says, the thing about this man is he's got character stamped all over him. And again, that was the lesson he wanted to give. It's not a sort of quote similar to what he said about Lee that I could point to, but that was a minor one that he said about Washington.
And you know, the messages of both of the books, but particularly the words that you read that he gave himself about what he hope would be a result of the book on Lee, those words are, if they were appropriate for the generation going through the Great Depression, they certainly are appropriate for the day and time in which we live. And just another reason that these words by Dr. Freeman about these two great Americans, two great Southerners, are timeless words, and all the more reason that folks today ought to be reading those two biographies as well as the one that you've provided for us about Dr. Freeman himself. So I thank you for not only for putting this great work together on Douglas Southall Freeman, but for pointing us to the things that he wants Southerners and Americans in general to share from those two great biographies too. We're coming up here on the end of our interview, David, but I do want to let the folks remind them that we're talking to David Johnson about his book from Pelican Publishing entitled Douglas Southall Freeman, and this is a book you can take a look at there on the Pelican website by going to epelican.com. If you're not familiar with who Douglas Southall Freeman was, he was the greatest biographer perhaps in all of American history. He wrote the definitive biographies of both Robert E. Lee and George Washington, as well as the book on Lee's lieutenants, which covers many Confederate leaders during the war. And David, I just want to thank you for your work with the book. I know it. You put many years into your biography here of Dr. Freeman, and want to thank you for being on the program with us tonight, too.
Oh, well, I really appreciate it, and, you know, a big thanks on this, not only to you, but, you know, Dr. Calhoun does a tremendous job, and, of course, I feel a great degree of loyalty to Pelican for taking this manuscript from a first-time author and doing such a marvelous job with it. And Dr. Calhoun has done a great service, nearly as great as Dr. Freeman, to the perpetuation of our history in a correct way, in an accurate way, that will benefit future generations.
And you know, David, that's what I hear from author after author, their words about Dr. Calhoun and Pelican both. What is it that led you to Pelican in the first place with your manuscript?
Well, you know, I was a rookie at this and didn't know what I was doing because it was my first book, and I made a lot of mistakes. But I went to one of the bookstores and I bought one of those, you know, big catalogs that has everybody listed,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I can't remember the name of it, but they list all the publishers and et cetera. And I just went through to try to find one that I felt would receive this in the spirit it was going to be offered, and yet and wouldn't just reject it out of hand, which I knew anything that had anything sort of to do with the South or mm-hmm. General Lee might be. But also would be a fully professional outfit, because not only, you know, you're not only interested in getting published, but you want it to be promoted and you want it to be handled correctly.
Right.
And by all accounts, Pelican was at the top of my list, and I really, in all honesty, I didn't think I could would make it with any non-university press. I thought a book like this would end up with just a vigorous university press.
Mm-hmm.
But when I sent it down and they gave it a full hearing, and I had good editors working with me, and they really just did a marvelous job, and it was a great experience. So I can't say I picked them. I hoped that I had picked them, but they picked me when I sent it down there, because obviously it's their call. But I was pleased with it, because I didn't have an agent or anything like that. I just looked them up and gave them the pitch, and it came together very nicely.
Well, you know, I can't imagine what mistakes you think you might have made in the book, having read it. You certainly didn't make any mistake when you chose Pelican to send that off to, though. I think it was a great matchup there with your work and with Pelican, and we're just glad that we have it there. From you and from Pelican, so thanks again.
Yes, sir.
And any other works that you maybe have already in the works, or maybe in the future for us?
Yeah, I as soon as I finished giving speeches and interviews when this book came out in 2002, I turned to my next topic, and so it's been another 6-year venture, I'm beginning finally to put some words down. It's mostly been 6 years of research. I think I'd like mm-hmm. to keep a topic to myself for the
okay.
time being. But hopefully by maybe the end of next year, I might have something that I view ready to be presented somewhere. But
great.
Yes, I went right to work on the next topic, and I've got a desk full of topics to follow this. So I hope to continue to write as long as I'm able, and to honor Dr. Freeman every time I do it by being assiduous in my research and precise in my facts, and presented as in a readable fashion and entertaining, I hope, as possible. But it is another a great, although somewhat less known, Southerner, as I would describe Dr. Freeman. So.
Well, somehow I feel that I get the feeling that your acquaintance with Dr. Freeman is something that has impacted your life in a way that has changed you forever.
Well, you know, he said when you keep company with great men, it's hard to turn away from that. And I kept company with him for 6 years, and it's hard to turn away from not only from being around him figuratively, but you always have a very high standard set before you. And everything I write, I'm thinking about how he did it. And as a matter of fact, one of the very nice things is that he and I won't keep you much longer, but he had a rolling book stand that he kept all his research on when he wrote his books. The family gave that to me after the book came out. So in my study, I have all of my research now on Dr. Freeman's rolling book stand right by my desk.
Oh,
so
wow.
He's never far away from my thoughts when I'm writing, because there is his book stand right with me.
That's great. That's tremendous. Folks, we've been talking to David Johnson, who is the author of a biography about Douglas Southall Freeman, the greatest biographer of Southerners in all of our people's history. It's a book you ought to take a look at on the Pelican website. You could do that by going to epelican.com. And that's going to wrap it up for another Pelican Pages segment here at Dixie Broadcasting. But remember, we come to you just about every Wednesday night with a new interview and a different author. And we hope that this has been informative to you. And if you enjoy what you're hearing, or if you enjoy the other programming that comes to you at Dixie Broadcasting, we hope you'll take time to let Pelican Publishing know that you appreciate them sponsoring Dixie Broadcasting. They're a big part of the reason that we're able to bring you all of the quality programming that we do all week long here at the radio station. So take time to give them a short call or drop them just a very short email and let them know you appreciate them sponsoring Dixie Broadcasting. And David, thanks again for being on the show. We hope that when you do get finished with that next work, that you will give us a call and let us talk about that one too.
Well, I certainly will, and thank you very much.
Yes, sir. All right, folks, well, we've got plenty more coming up all night long here at Dixie Broadcasting, so don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.